Britain says it will drop clauses in draft domestic legislation that breach the Brexit withdrawal agreement, just after clinching a deal with the EU. The UK becomes the first Western country to start vaccinating its general population in the midst of a global attempt to contain the coronavirus pandemic. China summons the acting top U.S. diplomat in Beijing to protest at U.S. sanctions on 14 Chinese officials over Hong Kong. Welcome to World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Now, Britain saying it has reached a deal with the EU to manage post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland. Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove says that London will drop clauses in draft domestic legislation that breached the withdrawal agreement. He says the agreement is in principle on all issues, in particular with regard to the protocol on the Ireland-Northern Ireland border. The deal is, however, separate from the ongoing future trade talks between London and Brussels. EU chief negotiators said earlier the bloc is fully united over its approach and will refuse any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Michel Barnier added that if Britain wanted access to the EU market, then it would have to accept conditions. The two sides remain at loggerheads over a number of issues. Britain has started mass vaccination against coronavirus, become the first Western country to do that. A 90-year-old grandmother has become the first person to receive the Pfizer vaccine a week after Britain approved its use. The country is planning to vaccinate 2 million people by the end of the year, and more next year. First in line for vaccination are the most vulnerable people, as well as frontline health and social care workers. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the vaccination campaign is a huge step forward in the UK's fight against COVID-19. The country is one of the worst hit nations by the virus in the world. It has 61,000 deaths out of more than 1.6 million infections. Saeed Puruza says a safety concern prevails among Britons as the government has started mass vaccination against COVID-19.
They have rolled out this vaccine. They're calling it V-Day, Vaccination Day, a term coined by the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. They have already procured 800,000 doses of it, although they have ordered another 40 million, which will be enough to vaccinate a lot of people, like 20 million people. Most of that 40 million doses will be available until next year, although the government here is saying that 4 million doses should arrive in the country by the end of next month. There are concerns about its safety among members of the public. One prime reason is that the vaccine was developed in 10 months, a process from concept to reality that usually takes years. Some even are saying 10 years. But whether or not it'll have the impact, are we going to see after effects or symptoms, is just something we're going to have to wait and see.
China has summoned the acting top U.S. diplomat in Beijing to lodge its protest at new American sanctions on China's officials over Hong Kong. The foreign minister said it had summoned the diplomat to express, quote, solemn protests and a strong condemnation. The ministry also warned of taking reciprocal measures. On Monday, Washington imposed financial sanctions and a travel ban on all 14 vice chairpersons of China's National People's Congress. Well, that's over their role in adopting a national security law for Hong Kong and disqualification of elected opposition legislators in the city last month. Beijing regards Hong Kong as part of China and has time and again accused the U.S. of interfering in its internal affairs. Syria's newly appointed foreign minister has visited Iran. Faisal al-Maqdad met with Iran officials and discussed the regional issues. Youssef Jalali reports.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Maqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani. Or the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restriction and help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering.
Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turkey has urged the European Union to play a role of an honest mediator in its deadlock with Greece over Ankara's oil and gas exploration in the East Mediterranean.
We expect the EU to always act strategically and rationally. We expect it to contribute to the solution of existing problems. For this, the EU should play a role of an honest mediator.
In a joint presser with his Hungarian counterpart, Çavuşoğlu said that Turkey is trying to improve relations with the bloc. He added that issues between the two sides can be resolved if the EU acts with common sense. Now, those comments came a day after EU foreign ministers said that they were considering sanctions against Turkey. The EU leaders are expected to discuss the issue in their Thursday meeting. Tensions escalated between Ankara and Athens in August after Turkey sent an exploration ship to the waters, also claimed by Greece. Athens slammed the move as illegal and requested the EU impose sanctions on Ankara. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says that he believes a win-win formula can be found in the row with Greece over the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, those remarks came as the EU is mulling sanctions on his country ahead of an upcoming key summit, Rajan Saklan reports.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firm stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc.
There is a division inside the EU when it comes to Turkey. There is an alliance led by France that is pushing for sanctions against Turkey due to latest tensions with Greece. There is another alliance on the other side led by Germany that is trying to reach consensus on a solution for the conflict. So the EU remains divided and imposing sanctions on Turkey.
Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving Uruç Reis vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
There are calls by a number of Nigerians on President Muhammadu Buhari to resign following the seemingly endless wave of insecurity in Nigeria. Our correspondent Juma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
Since we assumed office in May,
the call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the president to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leaderships in Nigeria in general and in northern Nigeria in particular to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers. Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Thank you for staying tuned. Time now for the news review. Welcome to the news review. The UN has raised the alarm about the worsening humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia's Flashpoint Tigray region. It says access to deliver aid there is desperately needed. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says that the situation in Tigray is increasingly critical, and it's vital that humanitarian aid, humanitarian workers are able to urgently assist the people there. Ethiopia's prime minister ordered its troops into Tigray last month after alleged attacks by the region's People's Liberation Front on federal military camps. Abiy Ahmed declared victory in late November and said that efforts were being made to restore order. However, continued fighting and lawlessness have been hampering relief efforts to thousands of people displaced recently. Nearly 100,000 Eritrean refugees who had fled their country years ago are also living in multiple camps in Tigray. Time now to discuss the issues. So joining me will be Abiyomi Ezekiba, editor of the Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit, and Bekele Teklu, African Affairs expert from London. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Over to Detroit first. Abiyomi, what can be done about this plight that the Eritrean refugees are suffering in Tigray?
I think that the regional leadership in the Tigray region is responsible for this crisis. The federal government under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed had just requested the postponement of elections due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they went ahead in September with elections. And then in November, they attacked the representatives of the federal government in the Tigray region. So the government really had no alternative except to move into the region to restore the authority of Addis Ababa. The government has committed itself to opening up a humanitarian corridor in the area, and also to cooperate with the Sudanese government in providing assistance to people who have fled to Eastern Sudan as well. But we have to look at the political dimensions of this conflict, and in assessing that, then we can make some judgments about the humanitarian crisis and how to resolve it as well.
Mm-hmm. Now over to London. Mr. Teklu, who's responsible for this, and what can be done to tackle the suffering of the people?
To be honest with you, the Ethiopian people were suffering a lot for some time. This is not their first time. As we speak, if we go in Benishangul, a lot of people are displaced. If we go into Wollongong province and the southern region, a border to Kenya and South Sudan, a lot of people are displaced, and a lot of people are killed and starving. There is all over an instability. So the only solution we might have is a general consensus among the people and have the right, you know, transitional system where all people are included in the dialogue.
Okay, and Abiyomi, are you optimistic that people could be reached out to?
The government has set up a new political party, the Prosperity Party, which the TPLF refused to participate in. There needs to be some amendments to the federal constitution. The system of federalism, as it has been enacted, particularly under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which took power in 1991, actually at the aegis of the United States under the Bush senior administration. Herman Cohen, who was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during that period, is still intervening and interfering in the internal affairs of Ethiopia. I think the federal system, as it is set up now, had favored the TPLF and the EPRDF, and they are quite disturbed that a new political dispensation is being ushered in right now, which is also connected with relations with neighboring Eritrea as well.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. We had Abiyomi Ezekiba, editor with Pan-African Newswire from Detroit, and Bekele Teklu, African Affairs expert, who joined us from London.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. As anyone who has experienced middle age will know, the process of growing old can be extremely hard on the human body. Your bones begin to leak calcium, your muscles begin to shrivel, the immune system weakens, and arthritis can set in. Poor posture and balance affect how you move about the world, while cataracts and deteriorating eyesight impair how you can see it. Heart problems and declining cognitive function eventually set in as people approach the end of their lives. These symptoms, however, can also be caused by something less common: space travel. Stay with us for an article in this regard, penned by Shi En Kim, a commentator and writer. The piece is titled, "To Study Aging, Scientists Are Looking to Outer Space." Stay with us for more of Shi En Kim's article. Spaceflight influences biology in dramatic ways, and people in space appear to experience the effects of aging faster than people on Earth. Now, scientists have gained a better understanding of space travel's influence on living beings than ever before. A slew of 29 papers recently published in the journal Cell, Cell Reports, iScience, Cell Systems, and Patterns examined the biological hazards of spaceflight in 56 astronauts, more than 10% of all the people who have ever been to space. The new study brings us a step closer to identifying the mechanisms underpinning the biological responses to living in space. More than 200 scientists demonstrated that space upends the genes, mitochondrial function, and chemical balances in the cells to trigger a cascade of broader health effects in spacefaring humans and animals. Susan Bailey, a radiologist at Colorado State University who participated in multiple of the new studies, says, "The entire human body is affected because space is such a different and extreme environment. The health effects associated with spaceflight have several similarities to aging-related disorders, such as cancer and osteoporosis. While spaceflight parallels to aging are a concern for long-term crewed missions into space, such as those that would be required on a voyage to Mars, the unique space environment also presents a unique opportunity to study the physiology of aging." Estimated that the heart, blood vessels, bones, and muscles deteriorate more than 10 times faster in space than by natural aging. This means to study the aging process, scientists don't have to wait for their biological subjects to naturally mature on Earth. They can harness the accelerated health effects by running experiments on the International Space Station. Scientists stress that the symptoms of space travel aren't exactly the same as aging, and many changes reverse themselves once people return to Earth. But the comparisons are still useful. Spaceflight is an immersive experience that spares no traveler, while aging happens to every Earthling, whether we like it or not. As such, life in space is a good model for understanding aging as a chronic process. Bailey says, the barren otherworld of outer space could even reveal new ways to protect ourselves against the process of growing old. All life on our planet has evolved under Earth's gravity and Earth's conditions, so we aren't optimized for living in any other kind of environment. Space affects different cells in different ways, says Michael Roberts, interim chief scientist at the International Space Station National Laboratory. Michael Roberts says, it's not a single acute exposure to toxic agents, for example. It's something that's long-term, chronic, and persistent. Living in space resets the body's equilibrium levels for functioning optimally, he adds, thereby rebooting the physiological norms of how cells respond. In microgravity, the heart bones and muscles don't need to toil as hard as they do back on Earth, so they languish from disuse. Liquids flow differently in space, and this may change the shape of fluid-filled tissues, such as those in the brain. The higher background radiation beyond Earth's atmosphere may also damage DNA and increase the risk of cancer. Even the slightly higher carbon dioxide levels on the International Space Station can throw off an astronaut's physiology. The new research on the health effects of spaceflight echoes the findings of a previous comprehensive health profiling of NASA twin astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly. The NASA twins study, Scott and Mark Kelly, involved 10 research teams monitoring the molecular and physiological changes that Scott experienced during and after a year-long sojourn in space. The researchers compared the changes to Scott's identical twin, Mark Kelly, who stayed earthbound during this time. From over 300 biological samples, the teams catalogued a series of bodily differences in the twin astronauts, including changes to the astronauts' gene expressions, microbiomes, cognitive functions, and vascular systems. In the twin study, Bailey made a striking discovery. Scott Kelly's telomeres changed in length. Telomeres plug the end of chromosomes to protect them from damage, much like the plastic caps that prevent shoelaces from fraying. They're a good indicator for aging, Bailey says, because their length are affected by all aspects of earthly living, from our diet to our lifestyle and even our mental well-being. Telomeres shorten as we age, and how quickly our telomeres shorten is an important marker of health. During Scott Kelly's time in space, scientists observed an unexpected overall lengthening of his telomeres. When he returned to Earth, however, his telomeres rapidly shrunk. Even though they were longer during spaceflight, he still ended up with shorter telomeres than he started with, Bailey said. Altered telomere length has been associated with things like cardiovascular disease, particularly short telomeres, she added. However, Scott Kelly's elongated telomeres during his time in space isn't a good sign either. Longer telomeres are also associated with cancer. You really can't win the game. As revealing as the twin study was, it only had a sample size of one, Scott Kelly, measured against the control participant and his twin, Mark Kelly. Now researchers are confirming the study's findings, including telomere changes, by examining dozens of astronauts who have spent months in space. Like in the twin study, the researchers recorded a suite of physiological changes and attempted to identify the mechanisms, such as specific proteins or genes, that cause them. Some of the symptoms of spaceflight seem to stabilize after a certain amount of time in orbit, such as decreased blood volume and changes in the heart and lungs. But astronauts haven't lived on the International Space Station long enough for scientists to say for sure that these changes to the body will ultimately reach a steady state. We've now got some foundational studies, Bailey notes, but it's still a little too early to say. Space is also a fitting environment for scientists to test drug candidates associated with aging. In a recent study, one research team at pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly tested whether an antibody drug could prevent muscle loss in mice on the International Space Station. The group leveraged space's biologically useful environment to induce muscle atrophy resembling aging and cancer. According to retired Eli Lilly cellular biologist Rosamund Smith, who led the research, Smith said, "In space, the whole body of the animal is under the effects of microgravity. An analogous aging experiment on Earth would involve raising mice in a weightless environment by suspending their hind limbs with slings, or simply waiting for the mice to grow old. But artificial aging methods on Earth don't provide a full body experience to age all the body's muscles at once," Smith says. The Eli Lilly researchers confirm that space indeed shrinks and weakens the muscles of the mice living on the International Space Station, matching previous observations in astronauts. Injecting the antibody drug into the mice preserved the mice's muscles. Such drugs could counter microgravity's pernicious effects on astronauts during longer crewed missions and be used as therapeutics back on Earth. It's amazing how widespread the effects of microgravity are on the human system, Smith says. There's a benefit to understanding and using space to help us learn about human physiology and therefore human disease. Scientists are also shifting to a new research platform that models human physiology better than animals, tissue chips. These USB stick-sized gadgets contain chambers and channels of cells bathed in liquid sustenance. Tissue chips typically host a concoction of cells representative of a particular human organ. Fluid flow in the chips is able to reproduce the body's inner shear and stretch forces, and a chip's interior walls provide anchor sites for cells to arrange and grow on. Essentially, tissue chips behave like a microcosm of the internal human body. Sonia Schrepfer, an immunologist at the University of California at San Francisco, led a collaborative effort to launch the first tissue chip experiment to the International Space Station in 2018 under the Tissue Chips in Space initiative by the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. Sonia Schrepfer's research aims to shed light on aging in the immune system and whether a waning immunity can be rejuvenated. If space sets off premature aging, then perhaps bringing cells back from space turns off or reverses that deterioration, Sonia Schrepfer says. Scott Kelly experienced a reversal in telomere lengthening after returning to Earth, and other effects of spaceflight, such as altered gene expressions and bone loss, also disappear after astronauts return to Earth. If similar changes are observed in her tissue chips, Sonia Schrepfer's team intends to hunt for a molecular trigger. Identifying the proteins and genes involved could aid researchers in developing reverse aging treatments for senior citizens and patients with abnormally sluggish immune systems. The researchers are on the chase as they prepare for a second round of International Space Station experiments launching in March of 2021.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
اختلاف شب و روز که در گردش جوری میگرده با تمایل
The difference between day and night and the creation of light and darkness is another sign of the wisdom of Allah. We as human beings experience day and night and their blessings. During the day, we work, and during the night, we sleep. Another case regarding the wisdom of Allah in creating this world is the accordance that exists between the natural elements. For instance, the air is in accordance with the plants, and the sea animals with the water of the sea. The water itself is a strange creation full of divine secrets. The wind and light are also full of secrets, and each of them needs specialized experts to write books on them and familiarize the people with their secrets.
این موقعیتی که کره ما داره مثلاً اگر این کره ما در این محلی که واقع شده
Look at the place of moon among the other planets. If its place is changed for some meters or kilometers, then everything on earth will be frozen or burnt out of hotness. Thus, there is a balance even in the position of moon among the other planets. This case is also true about the rotation of the earth around the sun. If the speed of rotation is a little faster or slower, then there will be severe consequences for the world and its inhabitants, plants and animals. Therefore, I really invite the people to read the books on Tabia or natural findings to see how much powerful Allah is. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khala of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths. The World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland during the first dialogue, said even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very, very dangerous and difficult situation. He explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of the countries still battle continued or returning transmission. He stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination do not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place." As the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has remarked, the pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers at news.un.org under the heading, UN says right decisions on COVID-19 now will secure a life of dignity for all. Please stay with us for more. Addressing the second and final day of the United Nations General Assembly's special session devoted to the coronavirus crisis, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said, "Critical decisions made now to address the COVID-19 pandemic will lead to a life of dignity for all people." The head of the United Nations agencies, along with scientists and other stakeholders, held interactive dialogues focused on the health and humanitarian response, the road to vaccines, and addressing the socio-economic impact of the crisis on Friday, 4th of December. UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed outlined United Nations support for countries going forward, including mobilizing the $28 billion needed to secure vaccines for all, regardless of wealth and location, and assisting authorities everywhere to operationalize inclusive recovery plans. She said, "This session comes at a critical moment. If we make the right decisions now, we can meet the humanitarian needs, reset the development pathways, accelerate implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, and secure a life of dignity and opportunity for all on a safe and healthy planet." UN General Assembly President Volkan Bozkir said in his opening address, "We cannot neglect our duties to the people we serve at this time of crisis, when it is even more important. COVID-19 has affected the entire planet and, by extension, every area of the United Nations work. although the pandemic is a global health crisis, impacts have varied across countries, as have responses to the crisis. According to the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, who delivered a speech from its headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, while many countries have been able to prevent or contain the virus through proven public health measures, this is not a fluke of geography or demography. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said these nations have proved the efficacy of science, solidarity, and sacrifice, paraphrasing a motto he has used throughout the pandemic. Ghebreyesus stated, "But where science is drowned out by conspiracy theories, where solidarity is undermined by division, where sacrifice is substituted with self-interest, the virus thrives, and the virus spreads." Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths. World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland during the first dialogue, said, "Even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very dangerous and difficult situation." Dr. Michael Ryan explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of these countries still battle continued or returning transmission. Dr. Michael Ryan stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination does not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place." As the United Nations Secretary General has remarked, the coronavirus pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, Executive Director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. However, David Beasley warned that next year is literally going to be catastrophic, as humanitarian needs double, with famine already knocking on the door of some 12 nations. He adds, as war drives hunger, fighting also must cease. Urging countries to step up, David Beasley said, "We can avert destabilization and famine and migration, but we've got to be out there sooner rather than later." He noted, "If we're strategic and put the funds of those particular icebergs before us, I believe that we can get through 2021 whilst we work with the vaccines and rebuild the economies so that we can have a better world and achieve zero hunger by 2030. The zero hunger target is among the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which all 193 United Nations member states adopted 5 years ago. The Sustainable Development Goals provide a blueprint for ending poverty, protecting the planet, and ensuring that all the peoples of this world live in peace and prosperity. Achim Steiner, administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, said, "The goals remain absolutely relevant because they are our compass for getting out of this crisis." Among the lessons that the United Nations Development Programme learned from the pandemic has been the importance of having good data, critical for targeting people in need, particularly in times of crisis, while issues relating to human rights and gender are now part of recovery plans. The administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, underlined the importance of the United Nations' work in responding to the socio-economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, which has disproportionately affected women and the poor. According to a United Nations Development Programme-backed study issued recently, he warned that more than 1 billion people worldwide could be living in extreme poverty by the end of the decade if we do not manage to make the right choices now. He added, "But actually, the opposite is equally possible. This is the moment. It is a generational moment in which we need to think about the future of development in very different ways."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Fear and sorrow are two grave maladies for every nation, every crowd, and every individual. Fear and grief are two grave pests, but they can be eliminated with this Quranic announcement. Also, if we show resistance, they will be eliminated as well. This is based on Quranic ayah as well, in case of those who say our Lord is Allah, and further stand straight and steadfast, the angels descend on them, fear you not nor grieve. The Holy Quran, chapter 41, verse 30. Resistance has the same impact. If you want to be free of fear and sorrow, you should place resistance and steadfastness at the top of your agenda. If you do so, you will have neither fear nor sorrow. These are based on Quranic statements. Mm-hmm.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, I should say that we have not properly carried out our duty in the area of the sacred defense. Of course, the tasks that our dear Sardar, the chief of the general staff of the armed forces, mentioned are very good and valuable tasks. Nonetheless, they are few. We need more endeavors. Notice that the more we drift away from the sacred defense era, the closer we should get to it, ideologically speaking. Why is that? This is because distortion is lying in ambush. The hands of distortion are waiting in ambush. Well, you men of war live today, and you can say something to defend, but in 20 years, many of the participants today will not be there. In 30 years, more will be gone. The hand of distortion might distort this brilliant part of our history. Therefore, we should work. We should increase our knowledge and information. The sacred defense literature should be reinforced. The sacred defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is not the case that we have epic, romantic, social, and even police literature, and therefore we can have the sacred defense literature as well. The sacred defense itself is a reservoir. Therefore, all kinds of literature can exist in it, and we can benefit from it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.